Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
This paranoid understanding of the world is basically what he writes for, and also if we see the movies, of course. But sometimes I think, I mean, I have put some thoughts into that in the book as well, like, why are people so attracted to this idea that there are some kind of master puppeteers who are controlling world history and so on? And maybe it relates to our anxieties of a late modern world, that is there more to it or not? I mean, some really deep existential questions, and then somebody comes and gives you some kind of narrative that tells you, wow, there's a great sacred history behind all of this, yes, that is hidden behind the lost symbols of, you know, an ancient esoteric tradition. And Dan Brown helps us to unpack that kind of idea, which makes it attractive to us to accept.
There is no single definition or form of Freemasonry. Indeed, the Brotherhood and its history are surrounded by an abundance of facts, fictions and sources. So writes Swedish academic and cultural historian Dr. Andreas Onersfors in his latest book, Freemasonry, A Very Short History, published by Oxford University Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the conspiracy myths and fictions surrounding Freemasonry and their 300-year history and ask, have they been misunderstood? This evening I'm joined by Andreas Onersfors from the University of Gothenburg, who argues in Freemasonry, A Very Short Introduction, that there will always remain a gap between insiders and outsider observations and their agreement upon any proper understanding of Freemasonry. Andreas goes on to argue, live performance of ritual constitutes the centrepiece of activities in Freemasonry and is one of its defining features that distinguishes it from the majority of other organisations. So, who and what are the Freemasons? What is their position in our world today? And will they always be distrusted?
My name is Andreas Onersfors. I am an associate professor in the history of sciences and ideas at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And my area of expertise is the history of the Enlightenment, 18th century in general, and in particular the history of secret societies and Freemasonry, press history, and history of science. But I've also recently worked more on more modern topics in the history of political ideas.
What an interesting range of scholarship there, Andreas, and really well done on the book. I might start out with a big wide open question, if that's okay. When I say the word Freemasons, what jumps into your mind immediately?
Well, a close fraternity, a boys' club, some mystery, and that is, of course, the first association you get when you think about the term. And it all depends on how much you know about it before and how much you have read or heard, which forms our preconceptions about a certain subject, of course.
Do you think it could be argued that the Freemasons are somewhat misunderstood? Like, I imagine when you're either at book festivals or academic conferences or even going out for a cup of coffee with a friend and you say you've just published something or more stuff in relation to the Freemasons, they possibly are asking you questions that are a little bit ill-informed.
Indeed. And that is both the fascinating issue with Freemasonry and the challenging issue with it, because when I started off my academic journey into exploring this subject, there was not so much to take from to get a clear understanding of what the phenomenon was and is and meant to the people in the 18th century that I mostly was interested in to understand, and why they joined and why so many eminent people joined. So there was not so much to touch on, and I was struggling to find good literature on this subject, and the preconceptions are a very strong part of the scholarship that was existent in Freemasonry up to then. So I decided I had to do my own research into that field to get a better understanding.
But why do you think perceptions of Freemasonry are a little bit negative? Like, clearly,
the associations of the membership are not kind of like a church choir, let's say, or a sports club, or, you know what I mean, like a hiking or biking club. The nuances are a little bit different. And some people would see the organisation as a little bit secretive and would possibly distrust some aspects of their organisation, as well as the quality of what they do.
Indeed. And that is, of course, related to that secrecy occupies an important function in Freemasonry within its own form of organization. And it's an organizational principle that distinguishes it from the rest of, let's say, a soccer club or, you know, some golf club or whatever, because everybody knows what people are doing, playing golf or soccer or an instrument. Whereas the point with Freemasonry is that, the Masons say, we have our own rituals, we have our own secrets, and we won't share them with others. So in my book, I call that a kind of advanced play around transparency and secrecy, a societal play, so to speak. You're playing with the idea of the secret as an organizational form and content of what you actually are doing.
So in the writing of this book, did you want to recorrect the record, Andreas? Or, you know, was that your primary motivation, or where were things springing from?
Well, 15 years ago, we had vague ideas in scholarship about how to work on the phenomenon. There had been some individual researchers in the United States and also in Europe who had done pioneering work, but there was a new abundance of sources for reasons that are related to the European history, because lots had been buried in the eastern part of Europe due to the Second World War. So suddenly we had a moment in history where historians had access to a huge abundance of sources. And on the other hand, we had we didn't have any substantial scholarship into the phenomenon. So it was a prime time for new research to be produced. And I was a part of that new movement into the subject area. And this book marks, so to speak, a summary of what that scholarship has achieved in the last 15 years.
But it's interesting, Andreas, that how we look at history and or the organisations or cultural movements around it is very much based on where we are today and how we're evolving. So if whether how you interpret the sources or all the different other artefacts of sorts that you're researching through, you're bringing a temperament or a mindset of somebody in, you know, somebody from today. And, you know, whether you could argue that we've loosened up a little and become more liberal. Now, I know a lot of people would think we're doing quite the reverse and becoming more conservative. How we understand a cult, let's say, is quite different to how we understood cult-like activities maybe 50 years ago.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, absolutely. I found it fascinating when starting to write about the book that we now can link on some solid scholarship from which we can tell the 300 years of fraternal history of the Freemasons in a new way, with new facets, and including such sometimes thought-provoking issues such as female participation or the entire field of conspiracy theories, and also intramasonic imagination like the Templar myth and esotericism and so on. And now we have sources and we have scholarship with which we can tell the story of this unknown fraternity in a much better and much clearer way. That was for me the primary driver in producing that book.
You talk about the different rituals associated with the Masons, and you write, Masonic rituals are placed within a symbolic narrative framework, pointing progressively forward through the degree structure. I'm just wondering, why do you think the Templar myth has really captured public imagination? Why do you think that is?
There are many different reasons for that. The first ritual structure as such, and the striking element of Freemasonry as a kind of school for the improvement of morality, of philosophy, is the idea that you cannot get everything in one step. You have to move in different steps. You have to portion out, so to speak, what you can know about yourself and about your relationship to the divine or whatever. So there's an idea about that you are initiated, that's your primary event, and then you get deeper and deeper into knowledge. And there is a narrative structure, as I said, because there's a story built into the rituals, a storyline, like in musical score, or a theater play, or a good book, you know. And then it's open-ended. And once you reach one end of that narrative, it's open for more things to happen. And one thing that happened during the 18th century was the development of this Knights Templar myth. And why that? That was your question. And I think there are different dimensions to it. One is that it was a defunct order of knighthood in a time when suddenly knighthood was something that was seen as something attractive again. Because during the 18th century, many states in Europe introduced orders of knighthood as a reward for their citizens. So what the Masons did was that they didn't care about that states were doing it, that we were doing it on their own. They were imagining their own knighthood, so to speak, that they would give to their own members. But why the Knights Templars? Well, the interesting thing comes in. Well, it's a defunct order. It was prohibited by the Vatican. And you have a story of a martyrdom that is trapped between secular and sacred powers that are not fair against you. And you can so to speak, write the story or tell the story about a neglected elite of enlightened people who actually want to do good for mankind, but are stopped in their endeavor by the evil machinations of political power and spiritual power. That is in the Knights Templar myth.
I'm just wondering, how do you understand the Temple of Solomon in Masonic ritual and the legend of Hiram? And, you know,
yes, exactly.
You know, what is the significance of all of that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that is the basic plot of the narrative structure I'm talking about is about construction, destruction and reconstruction. That is the basic narrative way that you can find in Freemasonry, because the Temple of Solomon is built by this master architect, Hiram, on the order of Solomon, isn't it? And then in the Masonic continuation of the story that you find in the Bible, the master architect is killed by three fellow craft Masons because they want to get to know a password for a higher degree, because they are greedy, because they want to have more knowledge, and things like that. So that is the tragic element where the temple eventually is destroyed. The next element is then the prospect of reconstruction, that you can, which is the continuation. The temple is destroyed. Will it ever be rebuilt again, and in what form?
So it's all symbols. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, of course, yes, yes. And that you can take as a symbolic narrative about your own life, human society in general, or, you know, human existence. So.
And clearly that's worked for lots of different individuals who have either connected up with the Masons or other orders, are using it or applying it into their own, I suppose, spiritual understanding of the world. But I'm just wondering, you know, Johnny Buddhist, let's say, or Matt the Atheist or whoever, and you're interested in some of the fraternal aspects of the Masons and some of their charitable causes. But all of that kind of Christian framework on how they go about recruiting and the rituals could really be quite off-putting.
It could. It was like that from the beginning. The Masonic rituals were clearly placed within a Christian framework of interpretation, but then during the 18th century, that was already toned down because in the spirit of tolerance. And then around 1800, you have two developments: one into a development where you have more secularized a group of rituals, and another one that retained the original Christian framework of interpretation. And then the third development is that came at the end of the 19th century, was to open up Freemasonry also for people who did not believe in a god or a supreme being, so to speak, to leave that open to them if they wanted to take an oath on the Bible or the Quran. So today there are three different frameworks of interpretation at play. The one is that has retained the Christian interpretation of Freemasonry. The second one that opens up for other religions as well, the possibility, I mean, of no specific religious background, but the belief in a supreme being, it might be Muslim or Jewish or Christian. And the third one that does not ask the candidates about any specific religious commitment. And theoretically also opens up for atheists to become Freemasons.
Presumably you have attended these rituals, have you?
Yes.
I'm just wondering, from your personal interactions with the Masons, what do these rituals fulfil for you in your understanding and lived experience of them? Like, what is their, what are the, you know, they obviously have a purpose or direction in terms of what they get of when course. They set out to do, but what do they do for you?
Exactly. Yeah, well, it's the point with the rituals is the performance. It is something that takes place here and now. As I said before, like a musical score, for instance, or a theater play, it is nothing that you can read, but that happens in direct interaction between people. So it is enacted in interrelationship between people in a specific time and place setting. So and that makes them so unique. I mean, you could read them and you could get some fair understanding of them. But on the other hand, I claim that is impossible, because it's like if you go to a concert, okay, you can record a concert and listen to it again. But I mean, you cannot have the experience of that particular concert at that particular moment again and again and again. And that is the important element here, the performative thing, that several people interact and something happens in time and space.
So like any other ritual, you know, you have pujas and Buddhism, you've lots of different, you know, you've different aspects of, you know, Christian celebration and ritual and all of that. I'm just wondering, from your first engagement with the Masons and taking part in all these rituals, did it change your understanding? Or did it open or give you a different perspective on them? Because it's one thing reading about the Masons in books, and you know, we might go into it later. You know, you quote Tolstoy, and you talk about Inspector Morse and lots of different cultural interpretations of the Masons. But I'm just wondering, how did it challenge your existing prejudices or not?
Yes, of course, and in particular for my ideas about other. I mean, we don't In the Western context, it's not so usual to have these kinds of initiatory societies. This is something that we either think belongs to an older period in European history, because such things existed in the Greek period, for instance. We had mystery cults. It exists somehow in the church, but not as fraternal orders. And in other cultures, there are. These kinds of fraternities that are enacting, as it is called in research, rites of passage, like between different ages or things like that. But in the Western context, we don't have so many instances of that, and that makes Freemasonry different. And in that sense, it retains something that is very old, or that is, so to speak, provides you with another perspective on the way of creating knowledge, and also another respect for maybe how things are in other cultures. Yes, and I think that makes also that it is like that makes Freemasonry also adaptable to a multitude of different cultural contexts. It's nothing that is entirely rational or possible to grasp with reason only. It's something you have to experience, and where you have emotions and feelings and reflections that are woven into the ritual play, so to speak.
You talk a lot about moral refinement and, you know, some of the kind of the more charitable aspects of the Freemasonry movement. And one of the things I was very surprised to read is, and you kind of unpack it to a degree, why some of the smartest minds in history have been attracted to the Freemasonry movement. I think you list Churchill, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, there's loads. But I'm just wondering, how do you explain that? Because, you know, again, like if it's a choir, if it's a bridge club, a sports club, you know, you're going to get all walks of life, aren't you?
Well, I think it has to do with the message and the organizational form, but it is always a hen and egg question. Were these people attracted to Freemasonry before they made their careers in life, or was it the other way around? Did Freemasonry give them something that inspired them to do big things in society? And having studied quite a lot of these people, maybe not on the top level, but, you know, in a specific historical context, I would say it's both, because you can see that great minds are attracted by the organizational form and the ritual play and the idea of welfare and charity. And then you have others who join, and then you see that they suddenly they do certain things in society that other people don't do. I'm particularly talking about the 18th century that was transformative for Western culture. And that tells me something that the organization and what they were doing and the rituals they were doing were sort of helping people to do great things in society that they possibly otherwise not would have done. And that's interesting because there must be there is something to it that makes it so attractive. And ideas of cosmopolitanism that you think I'm responsible for the world as a whole, not only for my own life or for society, but for society, the mankind in general.
You argue Masonic charity anticipated central aspects of the modern welfare system without necessarily having a particular political agenda. I thought that was really interesting because not a lot of people would associate the Freemasonry movement with charitable causes. So can you talk me through that?
Absolutely. Well, in organizational terms, Freemasonry was one of the first national organizations that on a national scale collected membership fees. The archives are very well organized still, and we can reconstruct that development that they were kind of taking in membership fees and gathering money for national charitable projects. During the 18th century, one of the primary projects that you would find in almost every European country were orphanages, for instance, because that was a burning issue, that parents died and many Freemasons around Europe collected money, for instance, to establish orphanages or to sponsor initiatives for inoculation against smallpox and so on. And as private organizations, the Masonic Lodges challenged the state in delivering political goods that we today would call welfare in that sense. One of the organizations I've been studying an all-European Masonic organization that existed a couple of decades in Europe in the 1770s and 80s, they were trying to organize a pension fund for their members. I mean, that sounds quite boring, but it's a fascinating story because we don't have any general pension funds at that time.
Can we talk about secrecy? Do you think it could be argued that secrecy is the Freemasonry movement's greatest strength? Like, I know you bring up, and it's a very amusing passage in the book, Inspector Morse and his somewhat unease, if not absolute contempt for the for the Masons. And it's you know, it always made for remarkable television and gave a nice kind of backstory into Inspector Morse. But it is a very credible charge because, do you know what I mean? Yeah. If I pop down to our local offices here in Dublin, it's not straightforward.
No, indeed. Well, I think that has to do with the particular history of Freemasonry in England because what started in at the end of the 19th century in Britain was that a development towards smaller lodges that also were for professionals. Yeah? So suddenly you would have a doctor's lodge or an academic lodge or a policeman's lodge. And whereas on the continent and in Scandinavia, you have larger lodges with, say, more than 100 members from all walks of life. And that was a particular choice in the development of British Freemasonry to allow for the establishment of specialized lodges for one particular profession. So you will even today find medical doctor's lodges or writer's lodges or fireman's lodges and policemen's lodges and so on. And that is something that is specific for the British Isles. And then there have been, you know, these cases where people have thought about, if the prosecutor is a Mason and the policeman is a Mason and if the accused is a Mason, what happens? Yes. And Freemasonry has not been particularly interested in trying to dispel the myth that there is something going on. So there have been some cases of high-profile cases of miscarriage of justice that have been associated with Masonic membership in the police force. That also have been investigated. But the problem is these rumors or, how should we call them? The perception of that there's something fishy going on still persists, so to speak. Yeah.
Do you think the principles of Freemasonry are somewhat incompatible with Catholic teaching? Like, the church has always had a very uneasy relationship with the Masons and so on. And I think, would it be right in saying that when you join the Masons, that you have to put your membership of the Masons above whatever religious group you're affiliated with? Is that right?
No, it's not right.
Oh, right.
Because and absolutely nothing that is written into Freemasonry.
So why do you think that is persisted? Because a lot of people would think that.
Yeah, well, that is. I mean, it's always a question of interpretation, isn't it? I mean, if you join a fraternity that places the Talmud and the Bible and the Quran on the altar, then you can might say as a Christian, oh, they are downgrading my religion to just one of all the others. And that's, of course, a take on tolerance you can have and say, oh, the Masons are making all the religions the same. But I would say that is a wrong take on what is happening in these moments when you know, all the Holy Scriptures are placed on the altar at the same time as they are in most of the British and American lodges, depending on who is a member. So therefore, I think if you understand tolerance in that way, you might feel threatened, for instance, when you come from a religious tradition where you have these kind of clear ideas about the doctrines of the church and who's right and who's wrong. And I think for the Catholic Church, there has always been a tension between what does the lay church do, who are the lay members of the church, and who is the church elite and establishment. And what happened in the 18th century that there were some high-profile people in the Catholic Church that were interested in Freemasonry, that were, so to speak, challenging that kind of power elite, yes, who is able to say what is right and what is wrong. And that was the starting point for the Catholic persecution of Freemasonry. That is number one. But then in the 19th century, there was another element added to it, and that is that in the Catholic countries of Southern Europe, we find that many people who are secular humanists are promoting the cause of free public education, medical care, and so on. They join Masonic lodges in clear opposition to the Catholic Church. And then the Catholic Church stroke back, so to speak, and was spreading lots of anti-Masonic propaganda.
Yeah. Andres, you used the word tolerance there. And I'm just wondering, within all of that, you know, how does the Freemasonry movement, or how are they seen to, or how do they promote tolerance in terms of like building in inclusive and a sense of inclusivity and that kind of openness and that transparency? Because that's very much how we operate today as organisations. Do you know what I mean? It's a prerequisite.
I think it is a contradiction that Masonry lives, so to speak, on the edge between transparency and secrecy. Because are we prepared to accept that or not? Do we want to have organizations that are completely transparent or not? And the answer of Masonic organizations has been different. Some have published their rituals and said there's nothing secret in what we do. We just we are secretive, but we are not a secret society. We are society with secrets, or these kinds of definitions that are kind of operating around that and are kind of describing Freemasonry as a gentleman's club with a charitable agenda, so to speak. That is one take of doing it. The other take is, as you say, in our times today of immediate presence on social media and so on, everything has to be, you know, transparent, and everybody wishes that it to be so. Yeah. But I think that we need to think in the terms that people also long for zones that are liberated of transparency, that where you can meet face to face in direct personal encounters without it having to be transparent. I think that's also part of life. I mean, I'm quoting at a couple of occasions in my book, an Austrian sociologist, Georg Simmel, who says that secrecy is one of the greatest accomplishments of humankind, because it allows things to happen that otherwise not would happen, and we have to live with a certain degree of tolerance towards secrecy in societies.
So what you're arguing there is that we have to be a little bit more spacious in how we, you know, in terms of our comfort with ideas of secrecy in order for secrecy to flourish. I'm just wondering, have you read many of the novels of Dan Brown?
Yes, I have.
And what do you think he's offered in terms of our understandings of the Freemasonry movement? Because he has developed quite suspicious conspiratorial narratives and done quite successfully with them.
Absolutely. No, I think two things with Dan Brown novels that I would like to highlight is that on the one hand, he makes a good story out of these kinds of Masonic narratives that anyhow are around, like the symbols or the narrative frames of the rituals, and it links back to different Renaissance or ancient traditions of wisdom and things like that. That is the one thing. The other thing is that he makes novels out of conspiracy narratives that already are around. So without the, for instance, in the one story I'm thinking about called The Lost Symbol, that is explicitly about Freemasonry, he makes a big deal of that. The entire plot of the story is built around the thing that if a Masonic ritual is revealed, then the reputation of the United States will now go up in the air. Nobody will anymore trust the United States if they see some kind of Supreme Court judges engaged in weird rituals that include skulls and swords and blindfolded candidates and so on. So he capitalizes on the idea that these rituals are so outrageous for the most of the people that if they are revealed, yes, then the image of the entire political community will be destroyed. And that is a conspiratorial reading that has been around in the press about Freemasonry since 300 years.
Well, he's done nothing original, but he is a smart writer in terms of how he's tapped into general collective unease and uncertainty and all that kind of paranoia. And we all feel very powerless in life that we don't fully actually know what's really going on. And, the powers that be, the apparent ones and the ones behind the powers. And Dan Brown has done that majestically, I would think.
Yeah, definitely, because, I mean, that is this paranoid understanding of the world is basically what he writes for. And also, if we see the movies, of course. But sometimes I think, I mean, I have put some thoughts into that in the book as well. Like, why are people so attracted to this idea that there are some kind of master puppeteers who are controlling world history and so on? And maybe it relates to our anxieties of a late modern world, that is there more to it or not? I mean, some really deep existential questions, and then somebody comes and gives you some kind of narrative that tells you, wow, there's a great sacred history behind all of this, yes, that is hidden behind the lost symbols of, an ancient esoteric tradition. And Dan Brown helps us to unpack that kind of idea, which makes it attractive to us to accept.
Yeah, he's also asking lots of other kind of existential questions and demanding so much of the reader. And possibly that in itself makes it so good rather than the actual content or narrative of his books.
Yes, yes. But I think he has captured the kind of psychology of our times. Mm. I'm also involved in an EU project on conspiracy theories where we are asking these questions really on a contemporary level right now and here, why so many conspiracy theories are so attractive in our current political situation in Europe, and you get the same answer almost. But politics these days, if you think about Brexit or the US elections, are growingly complex and abstract, and who is able actually to grasp all the different facets of bureaucratic politics or fiscal politics and then it is much easier to believe in the conspiracy narrative that tells you that our world is kind of governed of some secret forces, maybe good and evil, that are opposing each other, but, that are larger than us and that are more interesting than the boring details of ordinary politics.
Thank you.
on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Dr. Andreas Onnesfors from the University of Gothenburg, whose latest publication, Freemasonry, A Very Short Introduction, has just been published by Oxford University Press. I asked Andreas about the Nazi obsession with eradicating Freemasonry and what exactly transpired.
It is, but it's the Nazis inherited the idea of the Freemasons were a tool in some kind of a Jewish plot for world dominance. That was an idea that was born in around 1900 in different anti-Masonic movements, and the Nazis took over that idea into their own party program because that allowed them to construct credibility around their anti-Semitism. But then on the other hand, the Nazis themselves were also fascinated with the occult, in particular the SS organization. So in a way, they replicated the idea of that there should be some kind of pure elite knighthood that is devoted to its cause and developed lots of different rituals that you could say are, to a certain degree, taken from the entire imaginative world of secret societies and so also Freemasonry. So it's a kind of double relationship here. They want to vilify it on the one hand and say this is just a puppet of Jewish world domination. So Masonic lodges were closed down, persecuted, people put into concentration camps, libraries seized, archive collections seized. But on the other hand, their own fascination for ritual and the occult. It's a complex relationship, yes.
Women aren't allowed to be admitted to the Masons. And I know you do reference that in Northern Ireland, we have the unaffiliated order of women Freemasons. But I'm just wondering what your own view on all of that is, because any organisation, we've seen this in whether it's been golf clubs, whether it's been, you know, attacks on the Catholic Church itself, excluding half the population is never a good thing.
No, for sure. And I think that the 18th century was more tolerant than the later centuries, because pretty early there was a demand from the side of female relatives to Freemasons to join. And there was a kind of active discussion about the possibility of creating female lodges or joining the male lodges, which actually happened between, let's say, 1740 and 1800. But then we entered another century, and during the 18th century, you have romanticism, you have the idea of that gender actually is a biological category. And whereas in the 18th century, there was a more tolerance because you could think about that men's and women's brains are functioning in the same way, or human reason is universal and things like that. And all that collapsed in the 18th century, where you had kind of biological explanations for why women and men were different, and also why they should occupy different zones. So that women back to the private zone of the home and men out in society. And that was a kind of 19th century ideal. And therefore, female membership declined, and the small start of tolerance that was there in the 18th century disappeared. But it returned again at the point when we have the suffragette and the movement at the end of the 19th century. And since then, we have a more active formation of Masonic lodges for women. I think that, I mean, as an historian, I would definitely say it would be stupid to neglect this string of development in Masonic history, because it is there. And that is why myself and many other researchers push for to say we don't only have one unified form of Freemasonry that is male and blah, 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 but we have, for instance, also female Freemasonry. And it's a matter of tolerance toward that this is a historical phenomenon. And then, of course, as you say, I mean, it's difficult to mention a future where Freemasonry not would be open to women, but in fact, it already is. So, I mean, we have many organizations out there. And the question is only on what level do they want to collaborate? Is it on the organizational level or is it on the local level? And so on.
Well, Andreas, you know, when you're going, let's say, to, you know, take part in a Freemasonry ritual on whatever night of the week, your wife, she can do fundraising, you know, she can help you with some of the paperwork and she can do all those lovely activities. But she can't essentially go into, take part in a ritual with you.
Yeah.
So when you think about that from a membership perspective, you can understand why the Freemasonry movement is in decline.
Well, absolutely, but it all depends, because I have also met members of all female lodges. Yes, that say it is great to have a zone that is liberated from other men, so to speak. Yes, that are perfectly fine with to be among themselves.
Well, can I ask you a personal question then, Andreas? Yeah. Do you think Freemasonry has improved you in terms of your psychological understandings in life, or maybe how you live within a family, you know, the values that you bring into the world and the values that you espouse and how you act, whether it's in terms of friendships, relationships, intimacy, family, whatever it is, or even, you know, has it improved you as a working colleague to your other colleagues?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think helps and, you know, develops people?
Well, personally, I'm convinced of that. It's always difficult to back to a point in time where you not would have that kind of inspiration. But absolutely, I would definitely say that is something that helps you to develop another worldview and another take on both your personal life and interpersonal relationships and global relations on a larger scale. Yes.
I was interested to read that we have over 25,000 Freemasons in Ireland. And you bring up the Grand Lodge Room of the Freemasons in Molesworth Street here in Dublin.
Yeah.
And all of that. And it made for very interesting reading. But I was just wondering, as I was progressing through the book, I thought this was a really interesting cultural history and so on. But I did think to myself, well, it's coming from the perspective of a member. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I've no problem with that as such. But I'm just wondering, some of your readerships are some of those who are picking up the book now and go, well, of course he'd say that. And of course he's going to say this and that because he is a member.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you say? What do you say to the charge of critical objectivity when you're writing a cultural history of a very prominent organisation?
Yes. Well, I would say, I've got this question before, and I think people must understand that this is a book that is written from the perspective of I'm making available academic research into phenomenon. This academic research is based on how academics produce knowledge, and that means that everybody can check all the facts that are presented and have to come to the same conclusions. Otherwise, it's not an academic publication. That's based on these premises. Yeah? Oh. I'm not basing the writings on my own experience. I'm basing it on the facts that you can read about the organization that is based as such because you have in the list of publications, you will only find academic publications that have passed the test of academic knowledge production. I would never take my initiated viewpoint as the starting point of writing something about the organization, because that would be wrong. My take is it's an academic text based on academic research, and everybody who wants can check the facts on his or her own. That is the one thing. And then of course, we can always argue, because, I mean, you have Catholics that are writing about Catholic history, you have feminists that are writing about feminism, or vegans who are writing about veganism, and that must not necessarily mean that they are not as scientific. And that is, I think, important today to sort out when we talk about, like, you know, post-truth society and things like that. How can we be sure that something that is said in society is correct and lives up to standards of objectivity and so on?
Last question for you, Andreas. We have 6 million Masons throughout the world. And I know that you do discuss in the book, you know, the future of the Freemasonry movement and, you know, the ideas of rebranding and how they're organising themselves with regard to social media and all the technological innovations. I'm just wondering, as a member of the Order, do you think they'll always, you know, the Freemasons, do you think they're always going to be distrusted, always suffer public suspicion? question. You know, like in a time you talked there about post-truth societies, but you know, their lists aren't freely available. I can't find out who all 25,000 Irish members are. So I'm just wondering, when you say all this post-truth societies and all of that, you know, will they eventually be just trusted by some?
Yeah, if you want my view as an historian, I think that's impossible because it is a part of, as I say in the book, this play between transparency and secrecy is an organizational element of Freemasonry that is there and that always has greater suspicion. And either you can say, well, we answer towards that by total transparency. For instance, the Swedish Order of Freemasons publishes all its membership records. Yeah? Other organizations publish all their rituals. Either you say, we allow total transparency, we allow people in when we perform our rituals and blah, 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 blah. That is one way of doing it. But those organizations who have done so, it has not worked because suspicion prevails. So there's still an idea, this might not be the entire truth that we can see because they are so secret and maybe they're just playing some game and or the other way is that if you retain secrecy as a basic organizational principle, you can never come around the fact that you will be suspected of doing something that is not correct in the eyes of other people. Because that's a kind of basic psychology. And then, if I refer to the sociologist Georg Simmel, that comes with the very concept of the secret, because the idea that powerful people have some secrets, or the other way, that secrets give you power, is so strong in human history that you cannot get around that. And so my question is, no, it's not possible to come around suspicion, even with a huge amount of transparency. But my take as an academic is here that if you look at the phenomenon during the last 300 years from the point of view of academic research and the fact that we actually can research, you will still get a better understanding of it. And that's my hope, that academic research can help people to understand the phenomenon better. If they will get rid of their suspicions, that I don't know. I mean, you could also read a book about nanotechnology or stem cell transplantations or whatever that has come out on the Oxford University Press series, and people might still be suspicious about it, and that's the problem. I mean, we have to deal with that, and what I tried in this book is to assemble on the basis of scholarly produced facts and history of the fraternity during the last 300 years that can make people at least understand the phenomenon better.
Was Andreas Honorsfors from the University of Gothenburg. Freemasonry, A Very Short Introduction, is published by Oxford University Press and retails for in around €10 in paperback. I have to say hats off to Andreas. This is an illuminating read and very well put together. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of American philosopher and psychologist William James, who once quipped, "Truth is what works." Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.